Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Pakistani officials said a suicide bomber attacked a crowded public park in Lahore Sunday night, killing more than 50 people and wounding another 300. A government official said most of the victims were women and children. He said some of those brought to the hospital were seriously wounded. The Reuters news agency reported the bomb exploded in a parking area close to the children's playground. Witnesses said Christian families celebrating the Easter holiday were in the park when the attack took place. But it is not clear if the bomber targeted the Christians, who are a minority in Pakistan. Separately, in Islamabad, thousands of Pakistanis gathered to protest the execution last month of a man who had been charged with killing a provincial governor. Most of the protesters are activist members of Islamic parties. In 2011, Mumtaz Qadri shot and killed Punjab's governor, Salman Taseer. The governor had called for the country's Islamic law against blasphemy to be changed. Police fired tear gas to try to end the gathering, but the protest continued. The protesters were reported to be trying to reach the parliament building. Witnesses said police had little tear gas left to use on the protesters. Some of the demonstrators set fires near a public bus service center that links Islamabad with neighboring Rawalpindi. An army spokesman said the government had told the military to help control the protesters and protect the area of Islamabad where Parliament, the Supreme Court, and other important government buildings and embassies are located. Next, Christopher Jones Cruz reports on an attempted suicide bombing in Cameroon.
A girl who may have been planning a suicide bombing in Cameroon said she is one of the Chibok girls kidnapped in 2014. Cameroon officials received intelligence reports of three suicide bombers, all young women, crossing the Nigerian border into northern Cameroon. They arrested one of the girls before she could blow herself up. A second girl surrendered, and the third ran back to Nigeria. The girl who surrendered said she was one of the Chibok girls. The 15-year-old girl looked tired and in need of food. She could not tell them more about her time in captivity, or how she and the other girls were treated. In 2014, the terror group Boko Haram kidnapped 270 girls from a Nigerian school in Chibok. Experts believed they were taken to the Sambisa Forest, an area the group controls. People around the world protested the kidnapping. An international campaign called Bring Back Our Girls was launched. About 50 of the girls later escaped. Nigerian officials still do not know where the remaining Chibok girls are. Majiyawa Bakari is the governor of the northern part of Cameroon. He asked investigators to find out if what the girls said is true. Bakari said the terrorist group has changed the way it operates. The group has been using teenaged girls to carry out suicide bombings in Cameroon and in Nigeria. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
How long since I had a dream alone? I've heard when I was lost. I smile when I have grown.
China recently approved its first comprehensive law on charities and nonprofit organizations. The legislation makes it easier for charities to register and provides protections for people who donate. It also provides stronger government supervision of the organizations. Carla Simon is an American expert on civil society in China. She said there are two sides to the measure.
There are two sides. One is the charities come into being more easily. That's the charity side, and that they're permitted to directly register, and then the other, and more of them are. It applies to a broad range of charities. But the other side is, how do we protect the people who give money?
Lawmakers approved the new law at the yearly meeting of China's National People's Congress. The meeting ended Wednesday. Some people consider the law a government attempt to increase charitable giving. Donations stopped growing in 2011 when the media reported about the misuse of charity monies. The Britain-based Charities Aid Foundation recently rated charitable giving in 145 countries. It placed China second to the bottom. The legislation places a limit on yearly management fees. Charities are required to spend a certain amount of money they make. They can spend 70% of the amount given them that year, or 70% of the average income over the last 3 years. The law also provides tax reductions for people who donate. Chinese President Xi Jinping has pushed for greater control of civil society groups in China. The nation is considering a measure to place foreign nonprofit organizations under the jurisdiction of the police. The new charity law says that charities found to be threatening to national security will be punished. Officials might cancel their registrations, for example. Chinese police have arrested many human rights activists over the last 4 years, reportedly for national security reasons. Patrick Poon is a China researcher for Amnesty International.
In China, the definition of what it means by endangering national security would be very broad, and then also really subject to the authorities' interpretation.
Supporters say the charity legislation is aimed at strengthening approved civil society groups. This would permit nonprofit groups to help the government deal with the needs of the poor as China's economy slows. They say it will also permit China's new middle and upper classes to more easily donate to approved charities. Anthony Spires is a civil society scholar at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He said implementation of the legislation will be important to its effect on Chinese society.
It's going to come down to whether or not it's fully implemented at the local level. It's going to come down to whether or not Ministry of Civil Affairs officials at the local levels adopt a broad definition of charity or a very narrow specific one.
Spires said local officials probably will understand the law in a way that excludes organizations working on politically sensitive issues, such as women's or gay rights. The Chinese government has said it wants to end poverty in China within 4 years, and the new law is an attempt to reach that goal. I'm Mario Ritter.
Iranians are buying up property and providing construction workers in Damascus, Syria. But the purchases are raising prices in the country's capital city. Here again is Mario Ritter.
Iran's government wants its builders to buy up property in Shiite-majority neighborhoods of Syria's capital, Damascus. It is also asking construction workers to go to Syria. This information comes from construction industry officials in Tehran and Iranian experts. Iranian analyst Faribor Seremi said owning real estate gives Iran more control over Syria and other parts of the Middle East. Rich and conservative Iranian business people with ties to the government are buying expensive homes in Damascus, according to news reports. This is influencing price increases in Syria's real estate markets. 5 million houses have been destroyed in the civil war, Syrian economist Khorshid Ali Kah told Voice of America. The increased Iranian demand to buy land and properties has naturally led to more inflation in the market. Iran's interest in Syrian real estate is not new, but it increased after the rebel uprising began in 2011. Government-run media have been reporting recently about how Iran joined Russia to support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Assad's government has been fighting against rebels and the Islamic State terror group. Iran is not only asking people to buy homes and property in Syria. The country is also asking construction workers and contractors to take jobs there. One contractor said a fellow contractor with close ties to the Iranian government told him he had a chance to make money in Damascus. When we asked about the security, he said that the zone is even more secure than Tehran, Iranian contractor Amir Maghsoodloo told VOA. Iran is home to about 3 million people from Afghanistan. Many fled the war-torn country. Most earn low wages in Iran. They are being offered better-paying construction jobs in Syria. Some Damascus construction projects are run by Afghan nationals from Iran, said Tahi Esmali. He is an Afghan national who works as a bricklayer. He had worked in Iran before moving to Syria in 2015. Iranian interests are not limited to Damascus. Iranian business people and companies are looking to invest in projects in the central Syrian city of Homs. The Syrian military and its Lebanese Hezbollah allies recaptured Homs in late 2015. The Iranian government has supported Syrian President Assad. Recent reports in state-run media say that Iran increased the size of its Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria. I'm Mario Ritter.
Amazon bans customers who return too many purchases. Some customers say they just returned products that they didn't like. But the former head of Sears Canada says some customers are abusing the system and costing businesses too much money. Bruce Alpert has the story.
Tuan Doe of New York says Amazon has banned him from shopping on that website. The reason? He returned too many Amazon purchases, he said on his website, techwalls.com. Doe said he returned 6 items in the past 2 months. He said he was not satisfied with the quality of the products. Amazon first sent him a warning about his unusually high rate of problems, Doe said. Later, when his wife returned a bicycle purchased on her Amazon account, the company canceled both their accounts, Doe said. Mark Cohen is former chairman and chief executive officer of Sears Canada. He is not surprised Amazon and other businesses are trying to stop frequent returns. The costs are very high for a company like Amazon that offers many customers both free delivery and free returns, Cohn told VOA. The website dynamicaction.com reported that returns cost merchants $642.6 billion a year worldwide. But banning a customer can create bad feelings. Greg Nelson recently spoke to the Guardian newspaper after Amazon UK banned him from its shopping website. Nelson said he sent back 37 of the 343 items he bought on the website. He said he had a good reason for each return. I could understand if there were evidence that I had somehow tried to abuse the system, but I haven't, Nelson told The Guardian. Amazon said it only closes accounts in a tiny fraction of cases when it finds extreme account abuse. Cohen, the former head of Sears Canada and now a Columbia University professor, said many returns are valid. It is fine to return clothing that does not fit, is the wrong color, or arrived damaged, he said. But there are many cases of clear abuse. Cohen cites the example of people who buy a dress or suit, wear it once to a wedding or other special event, and then return it. Cohen said Sears Canada had a customer who bought items from the Sears catalog all the time and returned every single purchase. Cohen said it seemed the customer wanted something to do and enjoyed placing orders, getting them delivered, and sending them back. Cohen said he had to convince his staff to ban the customer. Some staffers said a ban did not fulfill the company's promise to completely satisfy customers. He helped write a letter to the customer. It explained she could no longer shop. Since we clearly have been unable to satisfy your needs as much as we have tried. Cohn had won the argument. On his Tech Walls website, Doe said he bought almost everything from Amazon. That included cheap items like groceries and toilet paper, and more expensive items like laptop computers. He said the returned items cost more than the products he kept, but he said he only returns products when they don't meet my expectation. Doe had some support from his online readers. Bob wrote that he too was banned for too many returns. It was a crazy high percentage in one bad month, but yes, they were all defective. I wasn't abusing, trying and returning, Bob wrote. Cohen said online businesses like Amazon are getting hit with more returns than traditional stores. One reason, he said, is that shopping online does not allow customers to try on clothing or take a close look before buying. Many products, he said, are returned after they have been taken out of their packages, often in bad shape. In the case of clothing, he said, returns often come in after the selling season ended for winter or summer. That makes them hard to sell or forces big price cuts, Cohen said. I'm Bruce Alpert.
A plant that has only bloomed once in 20 years is now again in blossom. Marcia James has more on this rare flower on display in Washington, D.C.
A rare plant at the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington, D.C. is now in flower. The blue-green colored climbing plant is called the jade vine. In the 20 years that it has been on display, the jade vine, also known as the emerald creeper, has only bloomed once before. Devin Dotson is the garden's public affairs and exhibit specialist. He says its blooms are going to just grow and grow and grow. The vines will go all the way down to the ground. So visitors, even down below, in another few weeks, are going to be able to see this magnificent color. The rare bloom is housed in the hot and humid jungle room of the Botanic Garden. The flowers grow high up in the canopy near the top of the room and then bloom lower and lower on the plant. This beautiful plant originally comes from the tropical forest of the Philippines. It is closely related to legumes such as kidney beans and runner beans. The blue-green shade of the flower cluster may look false, but it is very real. The flower is pollinated by bats and produces a sweet-tasting nectar. The flower is officially known as Strongylodon macrobotrys. It is only blooming for a short time at the U.S. Botanic Garden. I'm Marcia James.
Next, Anne Ball brings us a story about a recent discovery in Laos in this week's Science in the News report.
A new group of human remains has been uncovered on the Plain of Jars in Laos. They are believed to date back to the Iron Age, some 2,500 years ago. The Plain of Jars is in the central Lao province of Xian Kuang. The area covers hundreds of kilometers in which can be found thousands of ancient stone jars. They are grouped together at about 100 sites. The Plain of Jars has been a puzzle for archaeologists, scientists who study prehistoric people and their culture. A joint research team from Australia and Laos found the remains. Dogold O'Reilly teaches archaeology at Australian National University. He led the fieldwork in Laos. This is one of the great enigmas of the jars' sites, he said. These massive stone jars, some of them weighing up to 10 metric tons, that have been dragged 8 to 10 kilometers from a quarry site and set up in groups. Little is known about the people who made the jars. What did the jars hold? How and why did people place them where they did? O'Reilly said, a central question that needs to be answered is who created the stone jars? There are no known sites offering answers to the ethnicity and identity of the people who made them. The latest fieldwork uncovered an ancient burial ground in an area known as Site 1 in Xi'an Kuang Province. It has more than 300 stone jars, stone discs, and markers. The scientists uncovered different burial methods. They include burial of whole bodies, the burying of bones grouped together, and bones placed inside ceramic vessels and then buried. Louise Schoen of Monash University in Australia led one of the teams involved in the fieldwork. Archaeologist Tonglith Luangkort of the Lao Ministry of Information, Culture and Tourism also led a research team. Tonglith told Lao media that newly uncovered remains were found about 8 kilometers from the center of Phontsavan District. This discovery marks a significant milestone since archaeological excavations began in the area in the 1930s in collaboration with a French archaeologist, he said. Dogold O'Reilly said, the researchers hope to get really good information from the find. With our research, because we've been able to uncover a fair amount of human bone, we've got 7 burials and 4 probable burials with ceramic jars, so a total of 11 mortuary contexts. He said they are excited to have the opportunity to work at one of Southeast Asia's more important and probably least understood archaeological sites. Scientists will do isotopic and chemical tests on the remains. They may provide information on the ethnicity of the people connected to the sites. O'Reilly said, it is possible that the Lao sites may be linked to similar jar sites in India. The Australian Research Council is paying for the project. It will continue over 5 years with fieldwork in Laos and some in northeastern India as well. The effort may soon provide answers to one of Southeast Asia's greatest cultural mysteries. I'm Anne Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.